You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, podcast lovers. This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and we are in the second half of the 2015 season now. And the biggest question in the Central, can anybody catch those Kansas City Royals? We'll talk to Jeffrey Flanagan about Kansas City's clout. And we'll talk to Rhett Bollinger about a Twins team that, shockingly, is the only other one in the Central with a winning record right now. The Tigers are below 500 in the second half for the first time since 2010, so Jason Beck will join us to discuss what's going on in the Motor City. And Jordan Bastian and Scott Merkin will join us to discuss the Indians and White Sox, respectively, as they try to get going before the trade deadline. So thanks for listening. Away we go. Fresh off. Really active all-star game experience, I'm sure, is Jeffrey Flanagan, our Royals site reporter. And Jeffrey, yeah, break that down, that experience for me. The Royals obviously had their own wing of the visitors' clubhouse down there at Great American Ballpark. What was it like for you just trying to keep up with all those guys? And of course, Ned Yost had a mid-role in this game. Everything in that game went the way he wanted it to lock down that home field advantage for the American League.
Yeah, it really did. I mean, he was able to set up the final few innings, get Wade Davis in the game in the eighth, and he had Perkins and Batante. I mean, he had the all-time HDH all-star kind of closers there, and worked out perfectly for him. And they all had a good time. Lorenzo had a good game. Escobar had a pretty good game. Everybody kind of contributed. Of course, the funny part was Mike Moustakas being pinch hit, having a pinch hit there against 103 mile an hour fastball. It probably had the quote of the days. Well, I thought Ned and I had a good relationship, and of course, you know, he struck out like everyone else did. But it was a good experience for everyone. The guys enjoyed it, and no one got hurt. Lorenzo didn't hurt his hamstring any worse, so they came back. Pretty refreshed for the second half.
Absolutely, and we know going into the second half, the big question mark, the big storyline with the Royals is persevering without Alex Gordon. That injury happened since the last time we recorded one of these podcasts, and it's a huge blow in theory, although the Royals haven't truly felt his absence yet. What are your thoughts, Jeffrey, on how they've weathered the storm so far and the outlook moving forward?
Yeah, right now it's working out pretty well with the platoon of Dyson Orlando, and Orlando has hit three home runs since he's been called up, so you can't say they've really, really missed him. Dyson's played some spectacular left field. Paul Orlando's won two games by himself last week before the break, and then hit a home run yesterday, a big home run off Sale, to give them a cushion there and allow them to take three out of four. Long-term, though, I mean, I don't know if Dayton and Moore and his staff are going to be completely comfortable with that platoon. You may see them at least actively pursue a corner outfielder. We don't know, you know, when Alex exactly will be back. It's going to be at least September, mid-September, and he's not going to really be baseball ready, maybe not even until the playoffs. So that's the what they're talking about right now in the front office is what to do at that corner outfield spot. To either stick with what you got and hope it works, or go out and pursue a starting left fielder, which won't come cheap, of course, because everybody's looking for bats and everyone's looking for pitching this time of year. So right now it's working out great, but you got to be careful you're not chasing fool's gold here. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
Right, and then the other deadline question is the starting staff, which, of course, a lot of people are pegging the Royals to this guy or that guy. Johnny Cueto's name, of course, has come up. You've made the point here and elsewhere that this team might have too many starting pitchers just from a numbers standpoint. And now, you know, we really see that situation come to a head this week. Jason Vargas is returning to the rotation Tuesday. Chris Medlin joining the pitching staff, not the rotation. He'll go in the bullpen, but certainly looms as a rotation option. Moving forward. So how do they handle this logjam?
It's the question we're all waiting to answer, because they've got seven starters for five spots. They're not going to go to a six-man rotation. That's a definite. Everyone keeps associating them with names like Cueto, but as we've talked about before, they probably need to go the other direction and kind of jettison a pitcher or two and maybe get that corner outfielder if you can. It's just when we talk about free agent pitchers that they could acquire, well, actually they did acquire one last offseason with Chris Medlin, and he could be their big addition to the second half of the team. He's going to start out in the bullpen, probably a little bit of long relief, but they're going to have some hard decisions to make. The first one won't be too hard because they can send Johan Pino down as they activate Medlin. But when Vargas is activated tomorrow, a named pitcher is going to have to go. Some name that we're very familiar with, and it might be a Joe Blanton. We don't know. And then, of course, the other decision has to be made is who comes out of the rotation. And right now, you know, it seems like a shaky rotation, but they've been good starts over the weekend in Chicago. Danny Duffy was brilliant yesterday. You can't imagine them taking him out. Yordano's start of the year is their ace. He goes tonight. I can't imagine them taking him out. Guthrie's been pretty solid. Chris Young has been solid. You just don't know. And of course, Volquez has been probably their best overall starter all year. So I have no idea what they're going to do to take a guy or two out of the rotation. You know, Ned and Dayton always like to say, well, these things work themselves out. Well, we're at that time now where they have to work themselves out. So there's no more waiting around. There's no more injuries that you can fall back on and you know, put a guy in the DL. They're all healthy. They're all ready to go. And you got seven guys for five spots. And in the next 24 hours, they're going to have to make some tough decisions. And I'm curious to find out what they're going to be, just like everyone else.
You got to think, if Dayton's off-season batting average, so to speak, is any indication, you got to think Medlin could be a difference maker on this club, whether it be in the bullpen or even the rotation moving forward. What have been the reports on him and his comeback here?
It's been really, really good. I mean, his last outing a week ago, granted it was in Double-A, but he threw seven shutout innings, was commanding everything. Had his velocity up where it should be, 93-94. He's really the wild card in this thing, and I can't imagine him not being a part of the rotation at some point in the second half here. I just don't know who you take out. They want a second lefty in the rotation. That would be Vargas. Jeremy Guthrie is in the last year of his deal, so there could be some logic there to take him out, but he's been pretty solid lately. Both of those guys, Vargas and Guthrie, aren't necessarily good guys for the pen. They're more starters, long guys, than short, come in for a batter or two. But getting back to your question about Medlin, I think they got him in the offseason expecting him to contribute in the second half and contribute in the rotation in the second half. So I don't think it's going to be too long before he finds they wedge him in there somewhere. It's just a matter, again, of who comes out.
Lorenzo Cain, of course, is one of the all-star reps, and he's been swinging a hot bat of late. And really this season, Jeffrey, he's really matured as a hitter. I saw a stat the other day that his batting average on fastballs, second only to Miguel Cabrera in the majors. So that's some pretty good company, obviously. That's an area where he's probably grown quite a bit. But what's your take on Cain's development here this season and really building off that October? It was such a breakout October for him from a star standpoint.
Yeah, we just don't even know what his ceiling is. I mean, he just keeps kind of amazing us every day. I mean, 2 years ago, I would not have guessed in a million years that he'd be an all-star and this type of hitter. He struggled with pitch selection back then. He kind of looked like he had kind of an awkward swing. And now, I mean, he kind of hits off his back foot, which is kind of unusual, but he's so strong and he's got such a good eye and he can attack fastballs like that. That he just don't know where it's going to end. I mean, he's already got a career high in home runs. I never thought I'd see the day where he'd hit, double digits in home runs. And now he's just crushing the ball. And he's up around, 310, 320. And a pretty good on base percentage as well. And of course, he's Gold Glove caliber outfielder. You start to think about, he's not Mike Trout yet. I mean, he's not an MVP type player, but he's a candidate. He'll be on the list of the 10 guys who could be an MVP. So they really, And it, you know, there's a big difference, too, when Ned moved him up to the number three spot last year, and that really puzzled a lot of people because he really wasn't really driving the ball at that point. He was getting a lot of infield hits, a lot of kind of little dinkers to the outfield, and he kept his average up around 300, but he really wasn't a potent part of the offense. And since Ned moved him up to the number three spot, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they must be phenomenal because he had great the last 2 weeks of the season. He had great in the postseason, was the MVP of the ALCS, and has just taken off this year, too. And in the last few weeks, we've just seen this power stroke that we hadn't seen in him ever. So, yeah, the ceiling's just we don't know what it is with him, and I think Ned doesn't either. They're just kind of just sitting around and enjoying the ride.
Yeah, very exciting player. And I got to say, even as someone who lives in an American League Central city and sees the Royals quite a bit, I mean, last October was eye-opening even for me. It was like, geez, where is this coming from? And now he's really solidified that for a full season. I got the numbers now in front of me here, what I was alluding to earlier. He's hitting 390 off fastballs that end at bats. The league average is 273. Miguel Cabrera is at 400, and of course is injured right now. But geez, over we're talking about 117 points higher than the league average on fastballs. So that's been a huge key for him. Very fun player to watch. And the Royals have been fun to watch all season. Go ahead.
Yeah, they have. And he is crushing fastballs. It seems like he's crushing everything. The ball he hit the other day and on Saturday to win that catching game was a hanging curveball. He just belted it. And he's just kind of an amazing player. I don't know what quite to make of it because maybe he could be, you know, a 2020 guy. We know he can steal bases. He leads the team in stolen bases, too. And I've got to get that stat about what he's hitting since he moved into the number three spot in the order, which I said at the time was pretty controversial. And like everything Ned's been touching lately, it's turned to gold. So, I mean, even in the All-Star game, he made some curious moves there. It was pinch-hitting Prince Fielder against a tough lefty. And, of course, Prince belts a single and drives in a run. So, you know, it's just, you just sit back and go, okay, Ned, take over, because everything he does is right. So,
amen. I want Ned. I want to go with Ned and just have him pick out some scratch-offs for me. I'm not looking to bank. I'm not looking to win, you know, the $15 million prize. Just give me some scratch-offs, $200. I'll be happy. So I'm going to bring Ned to the grocery store.
I like that. I might do that when I see Ned in the clubhouse there. I'll just bring a whole batch of them for him and, you know, just hand them over to him. We'll split
it. There you go.
We've
got the magic touch. But, all right, we'll see what the Royals have in store in the second half, and the trade deadline will be interesting for them. And I am pleased to be joined by Rhett Bollinger, and the Twins just keep on keeping on in that AL Central race. Royals have created a little bit of a distance there, but, hey, the Twins are the only other team in the Central with a winning record, and that's something a lot of us did not expect going into the year, and, frankly, we're deep enough into the year that the bloom is not off the rose. It's a good thing for the Twins right now. Rhett, just give me the general state of the team, coming out of the break and still very much remaining in at least that wild card mix.
Yeah, absolutely. They had a nice nice finish to the first half there, winning 6-7. Crazy comeback win against the Tigers and swept the Orioles. Had kind of a rough series here in Oakland. Had a kind of a game that they came back and scored two runs in the ninth and they ended up losing it anyway in extras, and then a big beatdown on Sunday. But otherwise, they still have won 7-10. They put themselves in good shape going forward. You're right. It's like they haven't been in contention since 2010, and definitely a big surprise. But they set themselves up pretty well now. Irvin Santana looked very good in his last start, which is a good sign because he's going to be counted on for the second half. The rotation outside of, a poor start out at Tommy Malone has otherwise been good. Has been holding up really well. So I think that's kind of going to be the key. If the rotation can keep it up, obviously, if they can continue to get big offensive contributions from guys like Trevor Plouffe and Joe Mauer and obviously Brian Dozier, their all-star. Miguel Sano, once we kind of find out a little bit more about his ankle injury.
Yeah, you mentioned Sano's injury, and that's one of those, if you're a snake bit team and a guy steps on a baseball during BP, he could be out for the rest of the season. But they've had some good fortune this year, I guess, overall. And then Sano, from the sound of things, it doesn't sound like that's going to be a DL situation, or at least as we sit here today, it sounds like it's just a few days. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah. So this will only be about 3 to 5 days. Got a little lucky there, but one of those unfortunate things here where total fluke thing, he's taking some ground balls at first, and Eddie Rosario rips the ball down the line, it hits off the, you know, the protective screen over there behind first base, and it ends up behind Sano, and he doesn't see it because, you know, it's hard for him to know that ball hit that screen, and he backs up and steps on the ball, and sure enough, rolls his ankle. But the good thing was, is because of that, it wasn't like he was running and, you know, slipped or anything. He just kind of stepped on it and kind of rolled his ankle over a little bit. And when I talked to him on Sunday, his ankle wasn't really even swollen, which is a good thing. The test kind of showed he didn't really need x-rays or MRI or anything. So I think their hope is that it's definitely a minor thing, just a couple of days. And for now, you know, it's not really a DL thing. If that's the case, and kind of get by it just using guys like, you know, Torii Hunter or Joe Mauer to kind of get a day off. So in some ways, it's not too big of a deal, but it's only going to be for, you know, this Anaheim series. But at the same time, he's been a huge part of that offense so far. Just been called up.
Yes, yeah, it's been an instant impact there. And him and Brian Dozier, obviously Dozier's been doing it all year. Dozier did it again in the All-Star game, hit a home run in his first All-Star game at bat. And that just kind of goes with his season in general, Rhett. He's really had a power spike. Had a really nice season last year. But this year, he's already got 20 home runs, 27 doubles. What would you say is the key to the power surge this season from Dozier?
Well, I think with Dozier, it's definitely a surprise in the last couple of years. I mean, looking at his minor league career, I think his, you know, high in home runs in a season in the minors is like 8 home runs. He was definitely a guy that got on base a lot and was kind of like a leadoff type guy and a good defender coming up as a shortstop, actually, and turned up switches to second. And now all of a sudden, he's showing off all his power the last few years. I mean, last year, too, it's kind of the first year we really saw a spike, and he was in the home run derby. But this year, like you said, he's already up to 20 home runs, which, you know, especially as a leadoff hitter, is pretty rare. The big thing for him is he just loves high fastballs. Is able to pull them down the line and hit a lot of home runs to left field. I think he's only got one career home run to kind of the center or right center, and that came this year in Pittsburgh. But otherwise, especially at Target Field, much of it's a big ballpark, it is, you know, a little bit easier to hit the ball to left field there. We saw guys like Josh Willingham, you know, and even Plouffe had some nice, you know, years with home runs because you can kind of pull the ball down the line there a little bit. And he's done that, you know, kind of taking advantage of that where he just gets kind of fastballs or breaking balls up in the zone. Was able to pull it in the left. It's kind of like what he did in the All-Star game. That week in general was pretty incredible for him because, you know, he had 2 walk-off home runs that week, and he had a go-ahead home run on that Wednesday, and then all of a sudden he hit a home run in the game. So it was just a crazy week for him.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that was the question with Dozier going into the year was, you know, can he go opposite field a little more frequently and just to maintain his production pace? But like you say, right, he really hasn't needed to. He's done a lot of damage from the pull side. A guy they need to do some damage here in the second half, and he performed pretty well going into the break, which was encouraging, is Joe Mauer. You know, we don't expect him to be the MVP he once was, but certainly, you know, I label him a big X factor for that club, as it does look to secure a playoff spot here in the second half. What's the read on Mauer here?
It's been a really interesting season because if you look at his overall numbers, they're definitely down again. They're not too much different than last year. But for whatever reason, I don't know what it is, his numbers with runners on base and runners in scoring position are through the roof. I mean, he's been coming through in big clutch situations. The other night in their loss to Oakland, you know, they have 2 guys on and he hits a double off the wall to bring in the tying run, and then Sano got the go-ahead sacrifice fly. And then missed the home run, you know, yesterday in Oakland as well. So he's pulling the ball a little bit more, which is a good sign. And he definitely looked a lot better going into the break, and so far he's kind of kept it up. You know, early, obviously, in that series against Oakland. But, yeah, so if you look at his overall numbers, they're not as great, but his RBI total is definitely high because he's done so well with runners on. It's almost like he turns into a different hitter. Like, with nobody on, he hasn't been very good at all, especially for a first baseman. But as soon as they get guys on, he's able to drive them in. So it's one of the things I think they'd like to see. Obviously, that continue with guys on base, but some of that you never know if it's just kind of luck or just what it is. So I think they just need to get a big second half from him. And the way he looked kind of going into the break is certainly, you know, capable of that. We know his history, but as of right now, you look at that overall stat line and the overall, you know, batting average and everything else, it really isn't that much different than last year, which is definitely an issue now that he's a first baseman and not a catcher anymore.
While the team was in Oakland, they celebrated Torii Hunter's 40th birthday in style. Some nice gag gifts there for Torii. I saw Walker. What were some of the other gifts there, Rhett? They were loading up pretty well.
Yeah, it was pretty hilarious. So that day we came into the clubhouse, and I think Casey Fien was a reliever. He was kind of behind a lot of it. But we go into the clubhouse, and sure enough, they switched his chair for a walker that was one that you could kind of spin around. And it was pretty funny. And within the walker, there's a little, like, pouch-type thing, and there was a bunch of adult diapers in there. So those are kind of the 2 main ones, which was pretty hilarious. So he was kind of showing us all his new walker and going around the clubhouse and spinning it around and showing us how to use it and all that. And he was sitting on it in front of his chair throughout the whole pregame. And even, you know, I don't know, he tried on the diaper. I don't know if I want to ever see that again, but he did try that on for his teammates. But it was pretty hilarious. Obviously, he's a great clubhouse guy in there, and they had a lot of fun with him. And he had a hit in that game 2 weeks before that, and he still stayed productive in his 40s. And it sounds like from talking to him that he's starting to lean a little bit toward coming back next year, too, with the production he's had. But yeah. Either way, like you said, it's going to be with the Twins.
Well, that's great. You know, I'm, like most people in our business, always love dealing with Torii Hunter. Glad to see him in a place where he's happy and still productive. And you just don't see, especially in today's game, it's so hard to have that longevity, that durability. What's been the key to keeping him fresh this season? I know he's had his fair number of designated hitter days, I guess, working with Molitor to make sure he's on a good schedule there.
Yeah, I think it helps that Paul Molitor is his manager. I mean, Paul Molitor's career, he played until he was 42, and Molitor always likes to tell us that his year that he turned 40, Molitor played 161 games. A lot of it was because he was pretty much a permanent DH, but at least he kind of knows what goes into kind of staying fresh in your 40s and that kind of thing. So I think the big thing for them is just finding days off for Hunter here and there. And you're right, obviously, finding DH days, which have been a little tougher to come by recently just because, Miguel Sano's taken over as the full-time DH. But with Sano out now, they can kind of at least give Torii some of these DH days to kind of rest. He kind of fights it, but I think he knows that missing time early, will help him in terms of staying fresh late in the season, especially if they're going to be in the, that wild card hunt or even the division hunt late in the season where he's going to want to probably play every day just because the Twins need that in the lineup. It's just kind of one of those things where I think Molitor and him kind of have a plan and talk about it. Molitor gives him maybe a couple of days off a week here and there. And matchup-wise, too, kind of tougher matchups, maybe give him a break. I mean, they've got enough, outfielders right now where they can kind of mix and match. So that's kind of the big thing. And so far, it's definitely worked to perfection for the Twins with Hunter this year.
Rhett, last thing here. Give me the outlook for this club at the trade deadline. I know they're looking for a bullpen arm and maybe a bat. They have some rotation depth now. That took a little bit of hit with the Ricky Nolasco injury, of course, but and Irvin Santana coming back helps that. But, I don't know if that's something they would parlay into some help elsewhere, or I guess just in general, how aggressive do you expect this team to be here before July 31st?
It's going to be interesting to monitor. I mean, I don't think they're going to be super aggressive only because they weren't a team that was supposed to compete anyway. It wasn't like this was a team that was, only a piece or two away from the World Series. This is a team that kind of, that surprised people, and even if they were to make it, there are some holes in this team, but they have a lot of prospects coming up. They can fill those, so I think they don't really want to dip too far into their prospect pool and kind of sacrifice their future just for winning today, considering they said they weren't supposed to really compete this year anyway. So I think if they were to trade for anyone, it would probably be try to get guys that maybe have more years of control than just this year, and more than just a short-term rental. Definitely bullpen help is number one on the list. Maybe a lefty reliever especially. Aaron Thompson is kind of the primary lefty, and now he's down in the minors. Dunsing and Ryan Rourke have been pretty good recently, but I think a lefty reliever would be high on their list, and maybe even just a top setup guy. Boyer and Fiend have kind of struggled a little bit recently. And bat-wise, their two biggest holes right now are at catcher and at shortstop, but it might be tough to acquire either one of those, especially if a top one, like a primary one. I don't think the Twins are going to kind of break the bank and go after like a Jonathan Lucroy at catcher, or, even a Segura or whoever at shortstop, or a Tulowitzki. That kind of thing would just really shock me. I could see them maybe acquiring like a backup type catcher to kind of complement and split time with Suzuki, who struggled this year. But more than anything, I think they'll probably add a bullpen arm. And as for the starting pitching depth, there's a chance, but at the same time, because Pelfrey is a guy that's in his last year of his contract, so he'd probably be the most likely. But at the same time, I think they like having that depth, because knowing that Velasco's out for as long as he's going to be, and they have May in the bullpen, that if anything were to happen to any one of their starters, or if Tommy Malone, he obviously just had the one bad start, he's been great otherwise, but if he were to, struggle, or any of these guys were to struggle, they'd have May to kind of plug in there. I think they like having that depth for now. So I'd kind of be surprised too if they dealt from that. They do have Jose Berrios at AAA, so they have some depth for sure. But I think more than anything, I think they're going to target a reliever or two before the deadline.
And that might be enough. And the bullpen, of course, has been a huge separator for them, locking down leads. But it could use another arm. I think that's pretty clear. And we'll see if they address that, and we'll see if they can hold on. It's It's been a very interesting season so far for the Twins, much more interesting than a lot of us gave them credit for going in, and we'll see if they can keep it up here in the second half. I am joined, as always, by Jason Beck. And Beck, this is a different sort of podcast. This is a different sort of Tigers season. We are not used to being this deep into the season and seeing the Tigers in this deep of a hole. They are under 500 after the break for the first time since 2010. And, of course, 2010 doubles is the last time they didn't win the AL Central. So give me the state of that clubhouse. Is there panic in the Motor City right now?
I don't know if there's panic. I think it's more, the frustration's clearly building. I think you could tell a lot from what guys were saying after the game, just the level of disappointment that they didn't get off to a better start out of the break and have a better series this week. And I think there's even if guys aren't saying it, I think there's a realization that they're going to have to do something here in the next week to week and a half to make August and September mean something, but also to justify some sort of activity at the trade deadline to try to add to this team. I think where they are right now, it's hard to consider them really playoff contenders. They're going to have to make some distance. Even if it's not in the American League Central, I think the Royals right now look awfully tough even without Alex Gordon. They're faring better without Alex Gordon than the Tigers are without Cabrera. I think even if you throw the Central out the window, I think there's still a race to be made in the AL wild card. But they got to bridge the gap right now. They have to draw closer to really make that feel like a real playoff race.
One thing that hurts them, back from the wild card perspective, they're 18-29 against teams outside their division this season. They've actually, they've handled the AL Central pretty well. I guess familiarity helps there. They're used to beating up on some of those clubs, but outside division, they've really struggled. So you can look at a week like this where they're playing the Mariners and the Red Sox, two teams that have had their own set of struggles, and they're two sub 500 teams as well. But you can look at that as an opportunity, but at the same time, the Tigers have struggled when facing teams from the East and West.
Yeah, they really have. And some of the, maybe you can chalk up some of it to the time of year that they've played them. It seems like the division and non-division games have come in bunches. But
yeah,
at the same time,
they've had winnable
series that they haven't fared well in. You're right. And Baltimore was a classic example. That was a series that could have easily gone two out of three their way. They couldn't get the runs they needed off of Chris Tillman. In fact, they barely even got any base runners. And then when they needed a strong outing from Justin Verlander, they got a fourth inning exit with seven runs allowed.
Well, you know what question is coming next, Beck? It's the same question I think I posed you in our last podcast, and a question a lot of people are asking right now. You got Price, Cespedes, Soria, Alfredo Simon, Alex Avila. All these guys are pending free agents. I think I know the answer to this question, but just checking in on you here. Has anything changed, do you think, or could anything change on the trade front in the next 10 days that would motivate the Tigers to sell one or multiple pieces?
I think something could. I think if they have a bad stretch here, they definitely could end up, maybe not. I don't know if I'd call it a fire sale, but I think they could face a scenario where the logical route is to sell. What I'm hearing from people. And people who've been talking with the Tigers is that they're going to give it another week or so, maybe 10 days tops, and see where they're at and decide which way to go from there. I think if it's a status quo, then it's really going to be a tough decision for them. But it's going to be hard to and this is the other factor, is that with the state of their system, it's going to be, and given how many teams are looking for the same things that they're looking for, they're going to have a challenge trying to outbid other clubs for the top talent.
Right.
We're at that type of trade deadline season where the other contending teams, or arguably the more contending teams that are in it, they're looking to add are teams with deep farm systems, deep in what the Tigers have right now. I can tell you that just checking around the system over the last few days, there haven't been a ton of scouts coming around, which, now granted, that might not mean anything because it could just be a situation where teams have already gone through their routes and done their reports and they're just gathering a meeting right now. But around this time last year, you saw more scouts around than you have so far, this past week. And it's hard not to take that as a potentially frustrating sign for the Tigers as they try to get something done.
Absolutely. I almost wonder, your eyes naturally shift towards David Price because we're always attracted to those aces at the deadline, so to speak. I almost think Cespedes might have more tangible trade value this month than Price just because of the glaring need for bats in this game and in general. So I don't know. I'm just spitballing here, Beck, but
there's a point there, because for one thing, with Price, you at least have the compensation should you lose him as a free agent. And, any right. deal that gets done, you're going to have to beat the potential reward of a pick near the end of the first round, where Cespedes doesn't have that compensation. So
right.
if you're going to get something from him, unless you feel like you can make a major push to sign him this offseason, you want to keep him exclusively for that reason.
Right.
Yeah, if you decide to sell, I think he'd be one of the top pieces to go.
Yeah, he worked that into his contract, for those who don't know, that he's not eligible for the qualifying offer and the compensation that comes with it. So that is a major point there by Mr. Beck. Jason, Justin Verlander, he had an encouraging start just before the break, and then came Sunday. He got rocked by the Orioles. He was booed by the Comerica Park crowd as he left the mound. Fans understandably getting restless there, but you watch him and it's like, I think he has like a 75% fly ball rate since he's been back. It's only five or six starts, obviously, but it just seems like everything out of his hand, at least on Sunday, was middle in. What's your thoughts on him now? Because I would imagine, mentally you round that corner from, okay, this is his spring training to, okay, this is his season, what have your takeaways been from his first five or six starts here?
Well, the secondary pitches are there. I thought fastball command was terrible yesterday. I thought that was some of the worst fastball command I've seen from him in years. It almost looked like, he was basically trying to overthrow regardless of location, and wasn't putting the ball where Alex Avila was putting his mitt, or in some places wasn't putting it anywhere close. And I think he saw the second time around in the order, the Orioles caught on to that, and they just waited and feasted. The parts are there, I still believe. I know it sounds like a broken record, but right now it looks like he doesn't know what type of pitcher he wants to be. You see him have good sequences where he can start off guys with secondary pitches, work ahead, and then you see him, trying to power up where, he feels like he's got to get a swing and a miss. And those swings and misses aren't coming off the fastball anymore. That's not happening. And I think, if it wasn't apparent before, I think it's certainly clear now that whatever Verlander we see going forward, it's not going to be that power pitcher. I don't think that's realistic to forecast anymore.
Well, there's probably some hitters with some pent up aggression from past experiences with that fastball that are at least enjoying the current incarnation of Justin Verlander, but we'll see how he develops in the second half. And another big X factor in the second half is Bruce Rondon, and he's struggling a bit, not locking down that setup role like the Tigers hoped.
Yeah, that's it's opened the door for Neftali Feliz to come in and not only get a job really quickly after cutting ties with the Rangers, but also getting a setup job, essentially. Right. I think you watch Rondon, the velocity is there. The command is spotty. You see progress in the sense that he's mixing in more secondary pitches, but at the same time, you see him struggling to finish off batters like he did 2 years ago when he first when he first emerged. So it's going to be a work in progress, I think, and that's not good news for the Tigers bullpen. I think they need more of a finished product than what we've seen out of them. But I think, too, it's a reminder that here's a guy who really hasn't pitched competitive situations on this stage in basically a season and a half. And I think you're seeing the lost time really manifesting itself, and you're seeing a guy trying to remind himself or rediscover what it takes to get guys out at this level, as opposed to the AAA hitters he was facing for a month in rehab.
All right, there you have it from Mr. Beck. Beck, maybe on a future podcast, we'll just sit here and we'll read Miggy Cabrera tweets, because he's been tweeting quite often in his time away.
I could make. Do we have enough time for that? I don't even know. Jeez. He's going. You're going nuts there for a while.
Yeah. All right. Well, hopefully the Tigers get some kind of clarity here in the next week plus, because that trade deadline is looming, and they'll be a fascinating team to watch as it unfolds. And I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us. Joining me, as always, is Jordan Bastian, just back from the Natty. Jordan, JB, did you get any restaurant dining tips from Jason Kipnis? Because he spent a week in Cincinnati, a full week.
Yeah, he got a little hiatus there in the middle, and we went back home for a day after his
quick
four-pitch all-star appearance against Jacob deGrom, which four pitches was the most anyone saw against him, and he was quick to point that out, that he saw one more pitch than the other guys. Going to Cincinnati is always fun. We hit up Montgomery Inn for some good barbecue. You know, they got some good restaurants and things around the ballpark now, really built up that area. I was really impressed. I think you were probably there for the All-Star game, but just seeing what they've done with that riverfront there, man, they really did a nice job.
Riverfront and over the Rhine is awesome. It used to be a place you did not want to go, and now it's a place you want to go, so that's good.
That's right.
All right, shifting gears from Cincinnati, although something that happened in Cincinnati, there was this teachable moment with Francisco Lindor over the weekend where he was caught not running to first, and Francona sat him down and explained to him, see where he's at, checking in on him, that kind of thing. Let him know where things stand. You got to hustle the first, that kind of thing. But it doesn't seem like a situation where, they think Lindor is lazy or anything like that. It seemed like one of those moments with a rookie where you have a good opportunity to let him know what's up. But just in general, JB, Lindor's season to date, you wrote something on Indians.com about this. Just, he's hitting some hard luck. You know, the offensive numbers aren't what some people wanted them to be. But there's some bad luck in play there, it seems.
Yeah, and to go back to that teachable moment, I think the main point there with Francona, when he said it, he kind of sat him down and just said, is this the type of player you want to be? And obviously Lindor, as from talking to him as well, he really wants to be a leader and eventually maybe a face of this franchise. So he said no. And I think Tito was quick to say, he's not lazy. They all rave about his work ethic and, how much pride he takes in that stuff. So it was kind of just a moment where, hey, let's just make sure you don't get caught up in frustration. He pointed to Jason Kipnis, who takes out his frustration by running as hard as he can to first base. And that's one of the things Francona respects the most about him. But going back to his numbers, talking to Van Berkelio, the hitting coach, and Tito, and even Lindor, they're all quick to note, how hard he's been hitting balls and how good the at-bats have been, and the numbers really back that up. I was looking at the batted ball velocity on his hits and outs today, and he's well below league average, granted in a very small sample size, but well below league average on the amount of outs he's getting on balls that are hit batted ball speed of 95+, 100+, 103+. You know, so he has a lot of hard hit balls that are just going right at people, and the numbers really back that up. And what I was impressed with is when you talk to Lindor, who's a 21-year-old rookie, you know, it's really easy for these guys when they first get up to the big leagues, stare up at that scoreboard, see that low batting average, and get a little overwhelmed and, you know, try and get out of their approach just to get a couple hits. And for him to quickly bring up the amount of hard hit outs and bad luck he's had and, you know, stressing that he needs to just stick with the approach he's been taking, I like that. I thought that said a lot about his kind of maturity as a hitter. You know, hopefully we see more maturity on the field going forward, given that meeting with Francona. I think that was a good move on Tito's part, just to kind of, you know, treat this as a one-time thing and just use it as an opportunity, like you said, just a little learning tool.
Well, as far as the rest of the offense goes, the offense at large, I mean, I don't think, you know, going on the fact that you can strand 18 runners a game and hope that you get four bases loaded walks and a sacrifice fly every night, that's probably not a good plan going forward, as much as it did work on Sunday in Cincinnati. You know, JB, the three big issues this year, Brantley, Santana, and Gomes in the middle of the lineup. You know, those three guys were a reason to be excited about this offense going into the year. And then, of course, Brantley had the bad back in spring training, and that lingered into the season. Obviously has affected him, especially from a power standpoint. Gomes had the knee injury early, so he missed 6 weeks and just hasn't been the same hitter this season. And Santana, you know, we talked about him quite a bit, but just has not had that dynamic power season you hope to have from him. So as we move forward here in the second half, those three guys are obviously big keys. Santana really filled up the box score Saturday in Cincinnati. Of course, had the big second half last year. What are your thoughts on him as we move ahead here and knowing that they need to get that bat going? Do you think that's what we saw Saturday is basically sustainable?
Yeah, I think it's not just Saturday. I think if you look at July as a whole, Sunday aside when Santana went 0-for-5, July as a whole, he's been doing a lot more improved. I think he's hitting maybe a touch under 300. You know, he has some extra base hits. He's been going the opposite field a little bit more. Talked to Van Berkley about that. They said that they've been trying to tone down his leg kick a little bit so he can be a little more under control, and they've seen some results over the last couple weeks. And that's really positive. That's what they need, because this guy right there in the middle, you know, that's a big key to their lineup, especially with runners in scoring position, which has been a problem to this point this year. So encouraging to see what he's done over the last couple weeks, because we all know his on-base value and his ability to see a lot of pitches. But he hasn't been producing the runs as much. Slugging's been a little bit down. So it's been encouraging of late. The other guys you mentioned, Brantley, Gomes, I mean, even Brandon Moss, who had a really frustrating first half, admittedly. He said he kind of got away, went home to his on the lake where he lives in Georgia, and just kind of didn't even think about baseball for a few days. You know, he comes back, busts out of a 0-for-21 slump with a home run. You know, that was good to see those guys all contribute on Saturday, because those are guys that are all going to be needed down the stretch.
Absolutely, yeah. Moss, you know, the power's been there here and there. A lot of that power's come with nobody on base, which isn't great. And some, obviously that's not entirely his fault, because you need some guys on base in front of you. But, yeah, hopefully he's got some big swings in him in the second half. I guess you think about the trade deadline coming up, just kind of spitballing here, but Moss is one of those guys who, hey, maybe it would make sense if you can get something for him. Just knowing the general starvation in the market for power bats. But overall, I still come down to the Indians are best off just kind of standing pat with what they have, are they not? Because I don't know if the return on any of the potential guys they could move, I mean, David Murphy, it's a short list. David Murphy is a guy they could move. I just don't know if the return is worth it for a club that's still, you know, on the fringes of the wild card chase. And it's not like the monetary commitments are extraordinary. It's not like the return would be extraordinary. What are your thoughts on the trade deadline here as we're about a week and a half away?
Well, two things. I think, first of all, they look at their pitching staff as having the ability to create a scenario where they could go on a run and pull right back into that wild card race. And obviously, as we're getting close to the trade deadline here, you know, that kind of muddies the situation, because you know, you don't want to really sell, because you still think you have the staff capable of helping pull off a run to pull over 500, get back in the chase, and then see what happens down the stretch. The other part of it is just kind of maybe taking the approach that they did last year when they were in a similar situation last year, and that was they tried to subtract while remaining in contention. You know, they looked at Masterson and his Drubal as guys that were not going to be part of the future and said, well, how can we get rid of those guys but not, you know, decimate the team? And they actually improved in the second half after those moves and acquired some guys that maybe could be, you know, a part of the future. So I would think, I mean, if you could find anyone to be a taker for Bourne or Swisher, you know, given the sunk costs and the production that's there and the type of roles that those guys have been diminished to, or if you could find somebody, as you said, if you determine that Moss, given what his arbitration salary could be next year, just isn't going to be in your plans, then, yeah, maybe you try to do something similar there, knowing that, hey, maybe Swisher's coming back. You know, who knows what he's going to give you, but you can mix and match with the platoon guy. You know, Santana even, see, you know, explore the value for, you know, maybe there's a team that would, you know, value him a lot and maybe give more than what fans would expect. You know, that's a guy to maybe explore given the affordability of his contract. But I think it's got to be that sort of middle ground of evaluate guys who maybe aren't in your plans for the next few years, but don't just call it a season on this year given the strength of that pitching staff. And that's obviously a delicate balance, but I thought they did that really well last season.
Yeah, there's been a lot of chatter about Carlos Santana. I think they'd be crazy to deal him, frankly. I know he's having an abysmal season, but I also know that there's been enough there in his major league career to think that what's he under contract for, like $20 million over the next 2 years after 2015? So, I mean, for a small market club, those are the kind of contracts you've got to have. You know, that's a very reasonable salary, even for a guy who struggled this year. There's been enough in that bat in the past that I think make it worth keeping him. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that abysmal is really not the way to describe his season. I think he's such a polarizing
player. You're right.
I mean, either there's kind of the old school camp of fans that just can't stand this guy because they see his low batting average, you know, and they don't see the run production. And then there's the sabermetric crowd that loves him because he gets on base and he sees pitches, and even though he's hitting 220, you know, his weighted runs created plus is still above average and things like that.
Yeah.
So, but I think what everyone can agree on is he hasn't hit with runners on base and his slugging's down. And that's where it's created a problem. He didn't really like moving to the two-hole, and you saw the production slip. And then so now you got a lineup issue of where do we put this guy. And defensively, he went from the catcher of the future to the not catcher to the DH. Oh, he doesn't like the DH. Let's move him to third base. That didn't work. Now he's at first. You know, so he's created some limitations both within the lineup and defensively over the last couple seasons. But there is value there to be had. And I think it's just finding a way to maximize it. And like I said, if you were going to trade him, there are plenty of teams and plenty of forward-thinking analytical teams that would jump at a chance to get a guy like that. And I think that's what fans don't realize. I think fans think, oh, you're not going to get a bag of balls for this guy. Yeah, you get a lot more than a bag of balls. And that's maybe why they shouldn't trade him.
Yeah, and they're a forward-thinking organization as well.
Exactly.
Don't get me wrong, I did use the word abysmal. I feel bad about that. There is value to a guy who gets on base and sees pitches. But slugging percentage under 400, and like you said, runners in scoring position, just he's been invisible. So those are things that, you know, they need from him to outweigh that low batting average. So
right, and he's kind of also become the poster boy for the offensive problems this year. Batting with runners in scoring positions and bases loaded, I mean, this has been a team-wide issue. Just he's a cleanup hitter. You know, so that's why everyone's kind of jumping on him, and he's kind of become the kind of focal point of what has really been a team-wide issue.
Absolutely. Totally. And Nick Swisher has not moved the needle in that regard, obviously. You know, was in the lineup for a month plus there after coming off the DL, goes back on the DL. Give us the latest on Swishalicious as he basically is trying to work up a tolerance to play the outfield, right?
Yeah, and that was the idea all along. And I think, you know, admittedly, even Swisher said it was harder than he thought it was going to be when he first came back. You know, I'm not sure the Indians, you know, necessarily wanted to activate him when they initially did. But Swisher really kind of forced their hand. And, you know, they wanted to let him know, like, hey, you know, if you come back, we want you to play outfield. You need to be fully ready. And he clearly wasn't ready to do that. He played one game in the outfield, DH'd and pinch hit the rest of the time, and the numbers really just weren't there. And so I think, you know, they did the right thing on maybe helping him realize that he wasn't as ready as he thought he was. And, you know, maybe in the long run, that's a good thing. Now he goes down, gets this break, can kind of rehab a little bit. I think in Lake County, he's going to DH first. Then he'll get a game in the outfield. And, you know, I don't think it'll be one game in the outfield and then you're back up in Cleveland. I think they really want to see him go in back-to-back games and prove that he can, you know, really help the club in a versatile manner, which was the whole idea when they signed him. But obviously two knee surgeries can kind of cancel out your versatility pretty swiftly. So, I think, but like you said, that's the goal, especially when you have a team that, you know, Francona values being able to move guys around and having flexibility. You don't want a pure DH. You know, their goal when they parted ways with Travis Hafner was to move beyond the days of a pure DH. I think that's what they're trying to get to again with Swisher.
Yeah, they don't need a designated bro. They need a guy to play the field. So,
that's right.
All right. Well, see if the Indians can get going. I guess, you know, good schedule this week after the Red Series and the Brewers and White Sox coming up. Two teams very much struggling this year. So maybe this is a chance for the Tribe to get on track just before that trade deadline, and maybe they'll get back in that wild card chase. I am joined by Scott Merkin, fresh off the links, right, Merk? The White Sox.
You got it. You got it. A little quick 10 holes this morning as part of the White Sox charity's Field of Greens. Great cause. Great turnout too. I was a quote unquote celebrity, which makes sense since Bo Jackson was another one of the celebrity. When you say Bo Jackson, the name Scott Merkin follows shortly thereafter, usually.
Absolutely. Yeah, multi-sport stars.
Bo Jackson, man, Scott Merkin is not close to him in terms of athletes. That's how they usually follow in that order.
Well, only 10 holes, Merk? You couldn't go the full 18? What the heck?
No, you know, I hadn't played in 6 years, Anthony, and got a little bit, you know, as the age creeps up, got a little bit of the bad back, so I decided I think I'm going to call it quits at 10 and live to fight another battle, so to speak.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well,
thankfully, it was baseball, because although I will say that I think it was the seventh hole we played, I was the one who saved par for the group. So that's my one crowning glory of this morning. And I only swung and missed once while I was playing, so that's pretty good.
I got to say, I would much rather watch a broadcast of you on the links, Merk. That would be even better than the British Open playoffs. But speaking of playoffs, the White Sox, they're trying to get there. It's not looking good, Merk. I got to say, it's not looking good. They dropped 3 of 4 against the Royals over the weekend, kind of the same old story there with the offense just not getting things going. And, of course, with the trade deadline a week and a half away, the White Sox are one of those teams, you know, that people's eyes gravitate towards. I know there are reports out there this week about them being willing to listen to offers about Jeff Samardzija. And no surprise, they're not. It doesn't sound like they're interested in doing a total gutting of this club by any means. By that, I mean Chris Sale or Jose Abreu or anything crazy like that. So Marge is the one guy on this club who has tangible trade value and is, of course, a pending free agent.
Well, I think there's I wrote about this morning before I went out and golfed, actually, a busy day for me. I think that, you know, they really don't have to you know, I know a lot of fans are aggravated, and I get it, you know. People talk about they're the worst team in baseball in the last 3 years. But remember, you know, after about June and 13 to the start of this year, they really weren't trying to win. They were trying to strengthen the core of the team, the base of the team, and, you know, become competitive for a long time. So, you know, I know you hate to write off years, but hey, they did it on the north side of town, and it seems to be they did this kind of maybe more in-depth plan on the north side, and it seems to be paying huge dividends this year. They look like, you know, they're a playoff team as we talk today. But I think Samardzija makes sense because of the fact that if you really don't think you're going to be in contention, and let's face it, they don't look like a playoff team. Whatever happened with Kansas City or anything else, they've been a 500 to slightly below 500 team this entire year. This does not look like a playoff team right now. The thing about Samardzija is you can trade him and still go after him in free agency in the offseason, so you can really kind of double down on that bet. And, I mean, you know, he hasn't officially said it, but it looks, barring something shocking, that he will test the free agent market and kind of bet on himself. I would say if you really want to get out there, you could probably explore trades for, not explore, but listen to serious offers for Jose Quintana. Now, Quintana is one of the steadier pitchers you're going to find. On a good offensive team behind him, he'd probably be a 15-win guy, whatever wins matter at this point. Consistent 7-inning guy every time out. But the thing is, you know, you're not trading Chris Sale. You're not trading Carlos Rodon. And John Danks has got another year on the contract. And just, you know, he's a fifth starter who's going to make, you know, 14-some million next, 14 and 15, between 14 and 15 million next year. So you're not going to trade him. And so you got four lefties. Now, again, it's not a bad thing if they're all pitching well, and they all have pitched, you know, decently at some point this year. Some very good, as Chris Sale and Quintana have, and Rodon a little bit too. But I think if you're going to move one of those, maybe try and fill in some other deficiencies, Quintana would certainly be an interesting guy. Now, the flip side of that is he's controlled the 2020, and you don't want to weaken, you know, your strongest suit. But again, right, these, you know, suggestions about trade Sale and start from ground up, nah, I don't think they need to do that. I don't think any team really, I don't follow the Phillies enough to include them, I guess, or the Marlins, but I don't think any team is that far off that you have to gut it and then go back and contend. You know, you can't contend the next year. I think the Sox have enough good pieces that with a couple of shrewd moves by Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams that they can be a contender in 2016.
So Marja hasn't made any of this easy on the White Sox as far as giving a clear direction. You know, is he a guy you want to re-sign for long term, or is he a guy who has, you know, a huge amount of trade value at this deadline? It's been a very up and down year. 4.34 ERA going back to the beginning of June. But then he'll have a start like that one against Toronto, his last start before the break, where he throws a complete game shutout against the best lineup in baseball. It's just kind of been that Jekyll and Hyde routine this season.
And, you know, he has, I think, 11 of his last 12 starts, he's gone 7 innings or more. So, you know, yeah. I don't know if Jeff Samardzija has shown himself to be, you know, Chris Sale this year. Well, he hasn't shown himself to be Chris Sale, but I think Jeff Samardzija is the kind of guy you pay a lot of money for because you know what you're going to get from him. You know, I know his strikeout average is down a little bit this year, and, you know, he may not have been the pitcher, the exact pitcher he's been the last couple of years where he really seemed to be coming into his own, but you slide him in at number two or number three in your rotation, and you're pretty well off. I mean, I think the Sox, from all I've heard, are interested in keeping him. Now, you know, they'd have to, I think, really knock him out just from the little I've heard and the little I've talked to him to get him to sign before testing free agency. But I think, again, as I said, you can trade him. You can get the, you know, the profits from that and then go after him hard in the offseason if that's what you want to do. So I think you can get, you know, the best of both. And I think, I know, I've talked to some scouts, and playoff teams are interested in Jeff Samardzija. There's no question about it. There's no question that, you know, a team in contention would like to add him to the rotation. In this day and age, you pay a lot of money for guys who can work deep into games and work consistently like that and keep you in games because, you know, there are not as many as there used to be.
That is true. Hey, sticking with the pitching conversation here, Mark, I don't know how much attention you paid to Kyle Drabek, but he put up some good numbers in AAA, I saw. You know, and I guess that's a guy who they'd only turn to if they did deal out of this rotation in the next couple weeks. But any thoughts on Drabek? This was once a very highly regarded prospect who
right.
kind of fizzled out. What are the thoughts on him right now?
Well, I think he recently went on the DL, but, you know, he's had a great run for Charlotte, and he's in that mix. You know, I mean, that was a move they made at the end of spring training. He broke camp with the team, and, you know, I think he could be up there. I mean, again, you can also make moves to give guys like, and this is based on the fact that the Sox don't think they can get in this year to playoff contention. Now, you know, they're 7 back in the wild card behind both the Astros and the Twins, but they also have like 8 teams. I mean, they're closer to being the worst record in the American League than they are to a playoff team right now.
Right.
And there's a lot of teams to jump, and you can say, well, you win 8 of 10, you jump 3 teams, but, you know, it's almost like kind of coming back from a 20-point deficit in the NBA. You see a lot of teams do that, and by the time they get there, they're out of gas and can't finish the victory there. So, you know, I think Drabek could be one of them. I think if you look at trades for Alexi Ramirez, now, again, I don't know what the market is for him at this point because he's really, after coming off a great year last year, he's had a very, you know, down year this season. But would a team like the Mets, you know, want to plug in a veteran guy who's got some playoff experience, who's got big game experience, has had some big hits over his career, you know, has played much better defense over the last month? Would they want to give up someone to plug him in shortstop? He's got a $10 million club option for next year, and I don't think the Sox will pick that up with Tim Anderson in the wing. So maybe you try and move him and let Tyler Saladino play the rest of the year at shortstop. He's more of a natural shortstop and third baseman. And maybe even though he's not hitting very well or consistently right now at Charlotte, you take a look at Matt Davidson and see if that's really anything there. Is that going to be your future? Is that going to be anything? So I think those are the kind of moves that Rick Hahn can make where it can help the team now, you know, kind of like what they did with the Jake Peavy deal. Everyone won in that deal. Jake Peavy goes to Boston, wins the World Series. Iglesias was the shortstop Detroit needed. He's one of the best defensive shortstops in baseball. And the Sox not only get Avi Garcia, who, you know, is still in the developmental stage. You know, he missed all of last year, basically. And now you got Frank Montas, one of the harder throwers in the game, period. Not just the minor or major league level. He is one of the harder throwers, period. So, you know, it was a good trade for him. Those are the kind of trades I think the Sox are going to be looking for right now. They're not going to be looking just to get rid of, as far as I know, they're not, there's no edict to just cut salary and start getting rid of guys.
Merck, over the weekend, the 10-year reunion of the 2005 team. What was that experience like, especially having covered that team? What was it like seeing? They had a lot of turnout. This is the main takeaway, I guess. They had what, 25 guys come out?
Yeah, we all reminisced how young I was 10 years ago when the White Sox won the World Series, and how much that has changed in the 10-year period. No, it was great. It was great. You know, I thought one of the key things was really just to see Ozzie Guillen in his element. You know, Ozzie he loved that team. He was the perfect manager for that team. He was the perfect manager for how that team went up and down, and, you know, shouldering some of the attention when the team was struggling and letting them have the attention when they were playing well. And he just really seemed like the prodigal son had come home. And I'm not saying he's going to come back and manage tomorrow or be third base coach or anything, but it just seemed like he was back as a, you know, in the organization as a great fit. And it was good to see him, and it was good to see all the guys. You know, Carl Everett, Aaron Rowan, Joe Crea. I'm not going to list them all because we don't have the time, and I'm going to leave someone out. But you saw just the camaraderie that group had, and it's special. You know, I forgot which player said it to me, but I think it was Podsednik said that, you know, any championship team developed its own kind of feel for each other, its own chemistry. But this one even went beyond. And I still think one of the more underrated, kind of undervalued champions, a team that led from start to finish, never was in second place a day in the season, 99 regular season wins, 11-1 in the postseason, 4 straight complete games in the ALCS, and they finished the season with 16 wins and 17 games overall. So that's a pretty darn good run by that team. And, you know, they won a lot of close games. And people really enjoyed something. Now, I know the Sox fans are, you know, kind of torn. They love their champion. Just like the Bears fans love their, you know, Monsters of the Midway champion, you know, the Ditka year. But much like the Bears, the Sox would like another champion. But you can look back while looking forward at the same time and always appreciate what you have there.
That team really got tested down the stretch that season. You mentioned they went wire to wire as far as leading the division, but got a little nippy there going into September, I remember.
Yeah, I still argue about Cleveland that I think the Sox were in decent shape to snare a wild card if for some reason Cleveland made that gap up. But trust me, no one wanted to, you know, sneak in as a wild card when you were 37 over 500, or maybe even 39 over 500 at one point, and had a 15-game lead. And then I remember it had chopped to a game and a half. I distinctly remember Bob Wickman saving a game where the tying run was Konerko. And he swung and popped it up, and Konerko, like, flipped the bat. And you don't see this much from Konerko, like, emotion like that, where he knew, like, he just missed the pitch. And if I'm not mistaken, Joe Creedy hit a walk-off the next night, and that kind of saved the season. I still think to this day that after they clinched in Detroit and them going into Cleveland that weekend and sweeping Cleveland and knocking Cleveland out was kind of like their catharsis to get through that run and kind of turn it back on for the postseason.
Absolutely. They probably needed that in a tight race in September. Was probably good for them in the long run. They got October. And I remember the Ozzie Guillen doing the slash in his neck when the Indians were swept in that series.
Yeah, Ozzie had some moments. What a great guy to cover. And just the only problem is you were always tight on deadline getting stuff in, you know, before the game, because you could never leave Ozzie's session. And I used to joke with Scott Reifert, the VP Communications, that after Ozzie was done, they should sell, like, put tables around the dugout there, because, you know, he'd basically just talk about anything. So, you know, he'd talk 10, 12 minutes about the team and then go about another 20 minutes about baseball, politics, whatever. Very, very entertaining guy and a great fan. One of the things that's very underrated about him because of some of the, you know, the media stuff that's surrounded him over the years, is a really great baseball guy, too.
Absolutely. All right. I want to thank Scott Merkin for taking time away from his busy golf schedule to do this podcast. And hope you replaced all your divots out there, Merck.
A few. I'm going to try the U.S. Amateur whenever that's next. And I might be a little old for that at this point, though.
All right, everybody, that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. This has been MLB.com Extras, American League Central.